Hello, and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday, 1st of March, with me, Ian Welsh. As usual, coming up is the news digest and information on what's happening with us at Innovation Forum. Plus, we have highlights of a recent webinar where experts from BT and Total debated how to engage with procurement modern slavery risks. And last week, I caught up with Jessica Verhagen from Ecosphere Plus, and we discussed how far offsetting projects can help companies deliver their deforestation and climate change targets. Next, though, is a regular review of what's happening in business and sustainability. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization is the latest to issue a stark warning about the dangers of biodiversity loss impacting the planet's ability to produce food. A new report investigating the state of the world's biodiversity for food and agriculture states that our failure to protect the planet's natural support systems, the plants, animals and microorganisms that maintain productivity, is putting the future of food supply in jeopardy. The report contains many worrying stats and facts. Research suggests that over the past two decades, around 20% of the Earth's vegetated surface has lost productivity. Many key components of biodiversity for food and agriculture at genetic, species and ecosystem levels are in decline. The proportion of livestock breeds at risk of extinction is increasing, and the diversity of crops and fields is declining. More than 6,000 plant species have been cultivated for food, but only 9 now account for 66% of total food production. The FAO blames climate change, market and population pressures for the biodiversity crisis. Land and water use and management shifts are key drivers impacting ecosystem function. The better news is that the use of biodiversity-friendly practices in agriculture is on the increase. These remain diverse and disparate, however, and the FAO report calls for enabling frameworks to focus on the conservation of biodiversity for food and agriculture. A new initiative from WWF, partnering with Unilever food brand Knorr, is attempting to tackle some of the negative impacts of global food production. Titled The Future 50 Foods, the report lists some diverse plant-based foods that simultaneously reduce the environment impact of diets while boosting nutritional value. The report links a lack of dietary diversity with environmental impact, following on from WWF's Living Planet report late last year. Among the 50 foods that the initiative champions are wild rices, pulses and seeds that can have higher yields than many crops currently dominating food production, as well as more resilience to changing climatic conditions. And our changing climate is hitting the most vulnerable hardest and is responsible for humanitarian crises that go unreported, according to NGO Care International. The clear links between environmental impacts and human rights, affecting basic food supply, for example, are becoming an ever greater focus for CARE and similar organisations. CARE points to climate change's impacts leading to civil crises in Sudan, Chad, Ethiopia, Madagascar and the Philippines that were not given the international attention they merited. A new initiative from Accenture, MasterCard and Amazon aims to use blockchain ledger transparency technology to encourage customers to send donations to smallholder farmers and producers to reward good practices. When a customer scans a product label, they can access details of how that product was made and can send some cash direct to those at the other end of the supply chain. Connecting consumers in this way can have the additional effect of encouraging more sustainable practices in the field and demonstrating the value of transparency and traceability to producers and consumers alike. Finally this week, a reminder that when thinking about waste and disposal, there is no away. A paper in the Royal Society Open Science Journal shows that plastics now are present in the deepest parts of the world's oceans, meaning that there are no marine ecosystems left that are not impacted by plastic pollution. Scientists caught creatures from 6 of the deepest ocean trenches, including the Mariana Trench in the Atlantic, which is the lowest point on the planet at nearly 11 kilometres below sea level. Creatures from all the areas were found to contain plastic microparticles, leading scientists to conclude that these deep-sea regions are acting as the ultimate sink for our thrown-away debris. And while clean-up activities, such as they are, tend to be concentrated on land and in shallower waters, once plastic material reaches the deep ocean floor, it has nowhere to go and will simply accumulate and be ingested by bottom-dwelling creatures. Another call to action, if it were needed, on the need to tackle plastic and microfiber pollution. Innovation Forum's spring conference season is just around the corner, and it's your last chance this week to save $300 on discounted passes for Innovation Forum's discussion on how business can tackle modern slavery, forced labour and human trafficking on 30th of April and 1st of May in New York. Join experts from PepsiCo, Google, Barrick Gold, Coca-Cola, GE, RSPO and Humanity United, and many more. Sign up by close on Friday, March the 1st to get the discount, and I hope you can join us. And look out for the next in the Innovation Forum Winter Webinar Series coming up on Thursday, 14th of March, when we will be joined by experts from Barilo and Impossible Foods to discuss innovation in the food sector. Interview time now. Last week, I sat down with Jessica Verhagen, Vice President, Business Development and Strategy at Ecosphere Plus, and we discussed how carbon offsetting projects can help companies deliver on their deforestation and climate change goals. Jessica, perhaps you can start off by giving us a little bit of background into the work of Ecosphere and what exactly you do.
Ecosphere is actually the sales and marketing arm of Alphelia, an impact fund that was launched in 2014 to invest into projects that not only look at a financial return, but also look at social and environmental returns too. Then Alphelia was bought by Mirova in 2017 as part of Mirova's plan to have €1 billion under their investment into natural capital within 5 years. And I think for me, what's really exciting about that was their statement that this was what they saw as the up and coming asset class in impact investing was natural capital. So Alphelia a few years ago launched Ecosphere Plus to focus on monetizing the environmental assets from the investments that they're making. What we do is help businesses create and implement nature-based solutions to help them to align with global climate commitments, whether that be an individual climate target that a corporate has or perhaps a net zero deforestation target within their supply chain that they're trying to meet. We work with companies to use Alphelia's investments, which are largely into forest conservation, to help them to meet those targets.
Can you give us an example of what that specifically looks like in practice then?
Well, for example, one of our clients, Delta, they're an airline, obviously, in the States. They focus on reducing emissions to meet what they see as their customer demands around in the environment, but also their own. As a corporation, they've made their own environmental commitments, including carbon neutrality for the emissions that are above 2012 baseline. So that wedge that they're covering, a portion of that they cover with Ecosphere's project, but they also invest in a number of other projects in addition to ours to drive the market and really develop this area in advance of regulations coming down the pipe.
So for a client such as an airline then, what do you offer them? I know you have forest credits. So what are forest credits and how would they work for a client like Delta?
Forest credits are just one project type within offsets. They offer our clients a way to engage with their customers to increase customer loyalty and retention. We know that clients, particularly millennials, are really interested in environmental issues and not just interested, they'll put money where their mouth is. So you see brands going after these consumers with environmental campaigns and ways of doing things that take into account nature. So the forest credits can, in this case, offset emissions from a company. They could also be used to address supply chain issues. For example, we all know palm oil has been a big issue in the news over the last couple of years, and responsibly sourced palm oil is challenging. One of the ways that companies have been dealing with this is over time shifting their supply chain. But in the meantime, they use offsets from forestry projects to meet deforestation-free targets.
So your forest credits are essentially investments in forests that presumably prevent the forest being degraded in any way?
Yeah, that's right. Interesting question, because the money goes to a number of different sources on the ground. A portion of that is absolutely what you described, where we invest in park rangers, in protecting the area, surveillance. But then I think it's really important to note that part of Alphelia's or Mirova's philosophy is making sure that this investment is transformative. So when the investment comes to a conclusion, that the local population doesn't just go cut down the trees as soon as that the economic incentive is removed for the carbon credit. So the way that they do that is they work with what they call the buffer zone around the protected area to draft an economic development plan of where the community really sees itself moving into the future and helping them to transition to a more sustainable way of life going forward. So they don't have a job that relies on, for example, going into that forest and illegally mining, as they often do or did in our project in Peru, or going in for, say, slash and burn agriculture, as they do in many areas in Latin America. So we're trying to get to the root causes of deforestation in this approach, and by providing them with a means of getting them technical assistance and providing them with a loan to start up cooperatives. We get to the point where now we've got successful cocoa cooperatives running that are not just selling the cocoa bean, but the actual value added piece of our investment is we're investing into a cocoa processing facility on the ground. So people might not immediately associate that with forest protection, but for us, we're really trying to get to that long-term point where the people on the ground are stewards of the land, and we can enable them to be that if we have these options that for them where they don't feel like they just have to go and make money tomorrow. They can invest in their land. And we also, particularly with our project in Guatemala, help ensure that the local people have the appropriate tenure over their land, which can often be incentive for them to work closely with us in the first place, to make sure that they have their proper ownership over their land. So it's multifaceted, and that's another reason why I think brands come to us to work with us, is because yes, we can obviously deliver the carbon benefit, but then there's so many other stories and so many other impacts that are really well documented. I mean, being part of an impact fund means that our investors are expecting very robust impact reporting, and the same thing can be said for our corporate clients of the forest carbon offsets. They get that same quality of impact reporting that our own investors get. Plus, they can then use that in their own communication campaigns around what they're really doing. So rather than, I think, what they're concerned about is greenwashing, being able to show, no, this has real impacts, here's how we measure them, here's how they're audited, gives them a chance to really do something impactful that they can show the benefits from to their consumers.
Let's just move back a little bit to thinking around the offsetting then. I was interested in what you said just now, that you've identified that really taking a landscape approach is really the way to allow offsetting to deliver the impacts that your customers want. How much have you, as a business, taking a landscape approach now? How have you seen that develop?
For Alphilia, they really started off with a landscape approach where their mission was, as I mentioned earlier, to have a transformative impact, and they didn't see that happening in isolation by just working with the carbon. Additionally, as a financial investment, the carbon markets have gone up and down, and any other market for commodities goes up and down. To de-risk that by bringing in other commodities, agroforestry commodities that are grown sustainably and in a manner that uses fair trade, is more the direction that they're heading in, to diversify across that portfolio. So it doesn't just rely on solely the carbon in a financial way, but then in a, I guess, a social or environmental way, those impacts can really only be achieved with longevity if they're considered more holistically and not just the carbon. There certainly are projects out there that do just really focus on the carbon benefits. And I think Alphilia was trying a more unique approach in the market at the time to encompass more of these benefits and really go after it. And as you mentioned, in a landscape approach.
Offsetting obviously gets blamed continually for, and you know, not really forcing companies to deal with the root cause of their own emissions. How fair do you think that is? And how far do you think that offsetting is perhaps the only solution to really achieving net zero deforestation?
Certainly there have been cases, as there are with many different issues, where things have gotten off on the wrong foot. I think with offsets in particular, people can often see it as simply an indulgence for doing something they were going to do anyways. With Ecosphere, and one of the things that I feel really proud of is making an ESG standard within Ecosphere for the clients that we all work with. So we actually wouldn't work with a client unless they had committed to a corporate target for their greenhouse gas emissions. So we know that they're reducing their targets, and they really see offsets as a transition mechanism, not something that they plan on using indefinitely for the long term. And then on the question of, can we actually get to some of the commitments we've made as globally, like the Paris commitments, without forests? I think it would be really challenging to do that. You know, we've seen studies coming out, like the one that came out last year from TNC, co-authored with a number of others. One third of the emission reductions needed by 2030 can come from natural climate solutions, and they can be delivered fairly cost effectively for less than $10 a ton, which is quite affordable when you look at the list of options in front of us on how to reach those targets.
Let's think a little bit around consumer engagement then. I know that one of the things you do is allow your customers to have some carbon pricing at the point of sale. Why would a business want to do that?
Oftentimes, they want to be seen to be taking these actions with their consumers, and this provides them with a day-to-day way of that visibility. If it's just in a sustainability report, I mean, you go to the grocery store, you buy 20 things, you're not going to go look at the sustainability reports for those 20 different companies of products that you're buying. Whereas at the till, if you're compensating for your carbon footprint right there, you associate that with the brand. So we worked, for example, on a pilot with Ben and Jerry's and Poseidon, a nonprofit, to deliver carbon neutral ice cream to their customers, but with interaction that happened with the customer at the point of sale. And they even had a little screen on the side where they could see the number of trees being saved going up from their contribution. So if it was, for example, a penny per scoop that the customer put in and a penny per scoop that Ben and Jerry's had put in, they can actually see with each purchase at that particular store how many trees that store is helping to save. So it's quite a cool visual and a neat way of thinking about it and starting to consider what impact your own carbon footprint has over time as you make each purchase.
And do you have evidence for how consumer attitudes to this are changing?
We've seen for sure a huge shift, particularly with millennials. I referenced a little bit earlier, and there's a massive shift underway right now, with 83% of millennials being more loyal to a company that helps them contribute to social and environmental issues. So this kind of point of sale approach is one way where companies can show they're doing something meaningful on this, and it's participatory. The customer is going to actually be the ones that are adding. In this case, Ben & Jerry's put a penny in and the customers put a penny in. So we're not talking about a huge cost, but across a giant group of people, I mean, that's a really huge impact to have. And we started showing it in terms of the number of Hyde Parks that you can save by putting it into metrics that people can really understand as part of the service that we offer to the companies that we work with. So yeah, back to the millennials and the shift that we're seeing. It is the millennials that are kind of leading the shift, but then they talk to their parents, they talk to people from other employers, people that may be from other generations from them, and start influencing them as well. So we see the moms of millennials or the grandmothers of millennials picking up on these same trends and the numbers increasing over time in terms of not just talking about it, but the purchasing behavior is changing for these groups of people.
What for you are the limits to the success of offsetting, and how do you persuade your customers to engage in offsetting some emissions, but actually at the same time they're going to change their corporate behavior as well? How do you get around that?
Well, like I mentioned, one of the ways that we work with companies is to ensure that they already have a climate target or a deforestation-free target that they're working towards, and we just provide the transition for them. So for us, I mean, ideally, we'd like to see this part of our business decline over time. It's an essential part of the pathway at the moment to say, we get your supply chains can't change tomorrow. We get that you can't change technologies. The technology might not be available tomorrow. We're setting those goals for what you want so you can develop the right incentives within your company to get to those points, while at the same time, not just leaving the issue until you reach your target. I mean, unfortunately, some of these targets are in 2030 or 2050 to not do anything for the environment before then. That just doesn't, unfortunately, move us forward. So it's really important, in our view, to have offsetting be part of that transition path so their emissions are immediately addressed rather than being something that starts to be addressed in 2030 when a new technology kicks in, for example.
Sure, but I guess the challenge is to work with the companies to keep that momentum going forward. So yes, offsetting is an answer now, but then to keep developing the better and lower emission operations that everybody wants to see. Thank you very much indeed to you, Jessica, from Ecosphere. And thank you also for your support of our work and our landscapes event last year.
Great, thanks. I look forward to participating in it again this year.
Thank you very much. Our winter webinar series has been very popular so far, and coming up now are some highlights from a recent live discussion led by my colleague, Innovation Forum founder Toby Webb, with Tony Roy, Head of Governance and Sustainability BT, and Christoph Sassolas, Director of Global Procurement with Total SA. They ask how to make modern slavery a business priority for procurement.
Tony, why don't you kick us off by giving us a description of the journey that BT's on when it comes to procurement and social risk and modern slavery over the last few years?
So I've been with BT now for about 3.5 years. I previously was at KPMG and even before that at GE Capital. In terms of our journey into social risk, this is nothing new to us. Modern slavery was something that we looked at probably about 15 years ago in our supply chains, and we created what's called our own sourcing with human dignity standard that applied to all our suppliers. Even if you go back about 10 years, we recognized the risk that it could cause to the business if you had, for instance, incidences of trafficking or forced labor in your supply chain, which could have a direct reputational impact on BT. So as long ago as that, we started doing our own on-site assessments, I mean, which were all risk-based, of course, because we use what we call a funnel approach. So we look at category risk, the country risk, and the skill level of everything that our suppliers, what we buy from our suppliers. We've developed our methodology over the years, and with the addition of the Modern Slavery Act, obviously, that's taken on center stage importance for us. As Toby says, it's a journey. So I would say we're on that journey. It's not going to end anytime soon as we get new suppliers, new countries, etc. But it's something that we are quite well equipped to do.
I mean, I know you've only been there for 2.5 years or so, but what do you know about the journeys BT has been on here? I can remember BT 15 years ago being a bit of a leader in the space and starting to think about the supply chain. I remember someone at BT telling me all those years ago, you know, we got to 80,000 sub-suppliers and we stopped counting. How's that kind of length of journey, and how are those kind of big numbers affected your approach to this? You have to really boil it down, I guess, to the high risk areas.
Correct. Again, it's not something that I do on my own or my team does. We actually involve all of procurement. So as a group, we decide which categories are the highest risk. And that's based on a number of factors, like the location of the supplier, whether it's a product or a service that they send us, and also the type of skill level that we use. So typically, someone with a low skill level, like for instance, janitorial services or cleaning or something or security, is considered a higher risk because their education level might be low and therefore they're more likely to be exploited, whereas someone from a law firm obviously wouldn't be. So we've been doing that for a few years, you know, and we've been really fine-tuning our approach. To give you an example, I mean, there was an assumption that many of our engineers who work strange hours for a start, they usually work at nights or something in many countries, they could be exploited because of the hours they work or shifts and that kind of thing. The reality was they were actually very highly skilled people. And far from being exploited, they were considered valuable members. Similarly, there are other examples I could give you. But, you know, the whole point I'm making is that we've been able to fine tune our approach, but it's done collaboratively and it keeps changing. You know, the risk rating of a category does keep changing quite a lot.
Thank you, Tony. One more quick question before I bring in Christoph for some overall remarks about Total. BT's business has changed quite a lot. I mean, I worked for BT 20 something years ago when I was a student in a call center, and you know, it was a very, very different company back then. So just for our listeners who are unfamiliar perhaps with the changes that have gone through the company, just talk us through where you see the most material risk areas at the moment and what those supply chains look like in a high level way.
So, I mean, just to give you an example, BT now has about 3 or 4 key business areas. So one is, of course, our traditional telecoms infrastructure that we provide via wholesale and BT Global Services. So this is actually connectivity, landlines, broadband, and other such telecommunications. That's the core of the business. We also have recently, we've acquired EE, which is UK's biggest mobile phone services company. And recently we added something called BT Sport, which is a TV company which broadcasts mainly sport-related events. So as you can see, the mix has changed quite dramatically. However, the core services, many of them have remained the same. We're still buying a lot of electronics, for instance. Our first-line suppliers are the likes of fairly big household names like Nokia or Cisco or something. It's what happens below them that is a cause for concern. And that's something that we always keep an eye on. Mobile phone services, again, handsets and devices, those are areas that are constantly changing. And we change suppliers all the time. So it's getting on top of them because many of them are in very high-risk countries. So that's where our focus is at the moment.
Great. Thank you, Tony. And look, I understand it's a very complex business. Christoph, thank you so much for joining us from Total. You're Director of Global Procurement. Obviously, it's a very different business from BT, but equally, you have some big challenges. So I'd love to hear some opening remarks from you now about the journey you've been on and the most relevant issues you feel that you guys are tackling.
Thank you, Toby, and thank you, Tony. Indeed, Total, is, as you mentioned earlier, is a non-gas major, but it's also low-carbon energy. And in terms of activities, we're also undergoing, like many companies, quite drastic changes going into the renewable business and power distributions and many other aspects that we didn't tackle before. We have operations in about 130 countries and something close to 100,000 suppliers worldwide, which makes it sometimes a bit difficult to address issues like the one we're considering today. It's been a journey, and it's been also a personal journey. I've been in the company for more than 20 years. And clearly speaking, you've asked 15 years ago, 20 years ago, the general feeling in most companies, at least in Total, was, you know, modern slavery, human rights issue are a subject for governments and regulators and not a subject for private business. And that has changed drastically. I mean, today I don't hear anything like that in any of my worldwide teams or any of the staff of Total, and we feel directly responsible who we are doing business with. For me, I see three reasons why it's been so high in our agenda, and clearly human rights in the supply chain is one of the four key things that I'm broadcasting on our global procurement community. The first one, obviously, is the requirement to know who we are doing business with, and there's some red lines that we've put in the company. The second is our ability to make an impact. We, procurement professionals of big corporations, are organizing competitions in certain basins. And by organizing the competition in a certain way, we can have a positive impact and not stop negative impacts. And the last one is a bit of a selfish one I will develop a bit later, because I realized that in my staff, and especially in the younger generation, this is a very meaningful aspect of our job. So yeah, the first one is knowing who we are doing business with. We used to do that for many other aspects. HSE has always been high in the oil and gas industry. A safety issue, but now we're turning our point to clear human rights red lines, things we just do not accept in our suppliers. The second one is making an impact. We've said our goal as Total is to be the responsible energy major in the procurement function that extends to, instead of trying to mitigate the negative impact, trying to see if we can actually make a positive impact. And I've got several stories recently on us being able to change the conditions in certain in our suppliers. And the third one, as I say, is procurement is changing. And I think Tony mentioned that. It's not about cost saving anymore. And when I need to hire younger generation procurement professionals, when I say that on top of the competitivity and on top of many other aspects that we need to do in procurement, if we can have an impact on the people that are beyond the 100,000 suppliers, that speak to them and I get better recruits. It's a bit of a selfish reason, but I like that. And of course, that said, this is very well, but putting all those challenges and those words into practice is always difficult. So our philosophy is a bit threefold, I would say. One is clearly to set expectation in an extremely clear and coherent way. And so we've made the effort recently that the wording in our code of conduct, which is worldwide, the wording in the annexes of our contract, which tackle human rights obligations and what we call the fundamental principle of purchasing, are exactly the same. And the wording we deliver to our team are also exactly the same. As is, for example, a document that we got out last year, which is called the Human Rights Salient Issue, which is an effort we did to be more transparent on what are the issues in our industry, in our supply chain, in which country, in which type of goods and services we buy, we have issue. And the wording is exactly the same on all that. And speaking one voice to our suppliers is something that is very powerful. Of course, the second one, I'm sure we'll get into it, is of course everything that is linked to audit and due diligence. They've been around for a while, and one of the things we're trying to do is to keep things as simple as possible. Because, you know, when you have a big organization, when you have subsidiaries in 130 countries, you can't ask them very complicated things. You need to ask them to check very simple things to make the information available. So we're very much in a digital age, trying to simplify with a worldwide database of questionnaires, of audit results, and on sharing information globally. And actually, there's two more. Maybe it's a fourfold. The third one is also training people and making them aware, equip them with way to, and it goes all the way to training them on responding to a supplier if you have to make a remark. I mean, it's a bit like HSE a few years ago when we pushed the stop card. It's sometimes culturally very hard to tell a supplier, I don't like what I'm seeing. And so this is about training and awareness. That way on the local team, that's also work for my global team to try to make them aware of what's going on, because it's sometimes very hard when the only thing you see is on TV to make you realize what is really the life in certain of our supplier plans. And finally, the fourth one is teaming up. Recently, we announced with my colleagues from the four CPOs from BP, Shell and Equinor that we're going to share together all our audit results, be there paper, desktop, or be there physical audits. And I very much like that. It's something that we champion together, because first, it's about avoiding the audit fatigue, which is a real issue in our supplier base. I mean, when you send them questionnaire, when you go and visit them for various reasons, technical, HSC, human rights, and, you know, when the supplier supply 3 or 4 big corporations, they get 4 times the same effort. So we're trying to reduce that. So keeping things simple. And it's also sending a clear message to the market that we do compete and we like competition, but there's things on which we just do not compete. Human rights at the workplace and in the supply chain is something we just do not compete about. So, of course, it's a journey, but it's a journey that has made huge progress, at least in my own eyes, over the last few years. Things have been accelerated under various pressure, and I'm very optimistic, more than the transparency aspect, but on our potential to make an impact in the countries where we source and when we operate.
There'll be much more discussion, including representatives from BT and Total, on modern slavery issues at Innovation Forum's conferences in London and New York in April. And a reminder that it's the last chance this week to save up to $300 on passes to the New York leg. Just register by close of business on Friday, 1st of March. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.